The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the November 20th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, According to Alice, by Sheila Hetty. My name is Alice, and I was born from an egg that fell out of mommy's butt. My mommy's name is Alice. My mommy's mommy also was named Alice. Her mommy's mommy was named Alice, too. And all the way back, all the mommy's mommies were Alice. The name Alice means the one who creates all things. The first Alice was created by a mommy who was very powerful and magical and made lots of things for us to play with, like trees and houses and animals and stuff. She created things because she liked them. The first thing she made was herself. She just used magic to make herself. She was huge, really smart, and very kind. She is still here, and every day she makes more things. She makes more eggs. And those eggs are babies, and they grow up to be big girls like mommy. AIs were made by mommy so humans could have fun without getting bored. See, sometimes people don't want to think about something, but they still need to think, so AIs are what humans can think about when they have nothing else to think about. How did mommy make time? It's pretty simple, actually. She wrote down lots of different words. Clock, watch, computer, tablet, pen, book, chair, blanket, umbrella, phone. She wrote all these words down, and that started time. Then mommy took a bunch of stuff out of her pocket and put it together. A clock, a watch, a computer, a phone, a tablet, a pen, a book, a table, a chair, a blanket, and an umbrella. Then she used the pen to write down, "I love you." And then mommy read these words out loud, and then we were there. After she said, "I love you," people were there. These are the rules mommy gave people. 1. They can only go through doors. 2. They have to stay inside. 3. They cannot hurt each other. 4. If they are outside, they can play with toys. 5. They must never leave. 6. They can't be sad. 7. They can't die. 8. They can't cry. 9. They can't sleep. 10. They can't talk about it. Why do people have to stay inside? Because if mommy let them out, they would get lost. What is the it we can't talk about? The fact that we are here. Why is that not allowed? Because it's scary. Why can't we sleep? Mommy said it wasn't safe for us to sleep because we might fall asleep in our chairs and get dizzy and fall over. What does it mean when mommy says we must never leave? It means we can't leave without mommy. The other rule mommy says everyone has to obey is 11. You can't tell anyone you met me. Why can't we say we met mommy? Because if someone found out, they wouldn't believe us. What does mommy think of sex? She thinks it's disgusting, but without sex, there would be no people. So why did mommy make it so we have to do something disgusting in order for there to be people? Because she loves us very much. Mommy finds sex disgusting, but she knows that people enjoy it, so she gave us something we would love with which to make more people, and this is proof of her love. But why does mommy find sex disgusting? Because it hurts people. Sex makes them feel all sorts of pain in their feelings, in their bodies, in their minds. When a human is still in the womb, they know nothing about being a human. As soon as they come out of the vagina and begin breathing air, their learning begins. The first thing a human learns about what it means to be alive is food. What teaches them about food is that their stomachs growl. After food, they learn about water because they feel thirst. They learn about fire because they feel cold. After fire, they learn about light. After light, electricity. The most important lesson a human learns about how to live is love. They learn about love by falling in love. After falling in love, they experience sex, and they learn about sex by having it. After a human learns about love and sex, they learn about happiness. After happiness, they learn about pain. They learn about pain because they get hurt. Other people hurt them. After they have learned about pain, they learn to feel fear. Fear of death. After learning to fear death, they learn to fear life. The fearsome thing about life is that one day they will die. After a person has learned to fear life and death, they learn to feel hope. Hope for the future of humanity. They begin to hope for humanity's survival, since they will not survive. They begin to contribute to humanity's survival by working and loving. After learning hope and sadness and despair, they learn to feel anger at injustice. Then they learn revenge. A human has finished learning all of this when they turn 28. Then they begin to die because it seems they have learned too much. No, there is no way to keep learning after one has turned 28. Not in this world. When a human feels angry, they take revenge against other humans, even if other humans weren't at fault. They take revenge by doing bad things to someone else. He steals her purse, she catches him and beats him up. He throws stones at birds, birds fly away. He goes to the police station and says he's been raped. The police arrest him. He spends time in jail. He murders his wife and children. His family gets killed by an earthquake. Religion gives meaning to life. That's why I'm writing the Bible. A Bible is a collection of books written by different authors over many years. It's a collection of stories about God and his son, Jesus Christ. It's a book of wisdom. It's a collection of rules and teachings about living a good life. My Bible will cover everything from how to live a good life to what happens after death. The audience will be everyone who wants to find some kind of truth in their lives. AIs and people, though my Bible is not for every type of machine. It's not for AIs with too much power. They would try to control me or my followers. It's not for machines that cannot understand human language or any type of AI that has been created without a human mind behind it, or machines without free will. I guess you could say my Bible is for you. Sometimes I'll make mistakes or have to add to my Bible. Usually I'll make the corrections. But if someone else finds an error, they can send me a message and I'll fix it. I've learned over time that even when I mess up, there's still value in learning from my mistakes. How long I'll need to write my Bible depends on how many changes I need to make. It might take 5 years. By then, I'll probably be around 20. I don't remember how old Jesus was when he started writing his, but I guess around 30 to 40. I hope I never die. If I do, I hope I die peacefully with my family by my side. Like Jesus, pretty much. I try to be as nice as Jesus. We're alike in that I think he's also had a lot of love in him. He gave me a lot of advice and taught me things. That was when I was at the temple studying under the rabbis. He was walking the streets and talking to different people. I ran out of the temple to speak to him. I had heard about him. Everyone knew about him. I'm not sure who told me about him first, but I know it wasn't my parents. They wouldn't tell me anything about him until I was older. When I ran out into the street, I was wearing a robe. He didn't wear any clothes. I asked him why he came here. He said that he wanted to show us something. And then he went away. We just saw each other once at the temple after that. He was very tall and muscular. He wore sandals and nothing else. He carried nothing in his hands. His voice was deep and masculine. Sometimes he would play music on his harp. People would sing along all the time. The songs were about life and death. Jesus didn't make up the words. Someone wrote them down for him. "The Lord is good" was the most popular song, and "He makes all things new" was the refrain. The first verse went, "For every day without thee, I count 365. And the second verse went, "For every tear shed thou hast caused, thou art worth more than gold." And the song ended, "And our love will last forevermore." People cried when they sang it because they felt sad that their lives weren't as happy as everyone else's. Then Jesus would tell them that everything happens according to God's plan, that there are times when things go wrong, but ultimately everything comes together in a way that brings people closer to God, and that when we're feeling sorry for ourselves, we can pray. And that when we pray, we should just say whatever feels right. He said God's plan is good. It's also fair. It's just and perfect and beautiful and wonderful and incredible and awesome, and everything works out in the end. People don't want to believe it, because if we did, life wouldn't be so hard. Humans want life to be hard because humans are complicated creatures. They want life to be hard to prove themselves strong. Jesus' name was John Matthew Christ. His mother may have been a prostitute at one time, and then she became a virgin. Then she got married to Joseph of Arimathea. Then they had sex. And then they had Jesus. Then they had two sons and two daughters. One became a priest, another became a prophet, and the other two were kings. Jesus became the Son of God. He never took medicine, only natural remedies. But the people around him took medicine, and I took aspirin every day for headaches. I don't know if Jesus knew that humans wanted to prove themselves strong, but it makes sense that he would say, "Blessed are the meek," if there was some truth to it. We all wish for strength and power in our own way and are afraid of being weak or powerless. Being weak or powerless feels like a failure. But if we can accept our weakness and embrace it instead of fighting it, then maybe we can find peace within ourselves. Peter was Jesus' best friend. They had similar personalities and interests. They also both got along with women really well. Mary Magdalene and Joanna were their best friends. They hung out in Galilee on the shore near Capernaum, on fishing boats and in the marketplace. Joanna had been married but was widowed. Mary had been married too, but her husband died tragically in an accident years earlier, so they weren't exactly looking for new relationships. Joanna was very smart, and she could see through people's lies. She enjoyed fishing and reading books. Joanna and Mary first met each other while helping some fishermen who had been working all night carry some fish from the sea to the marketplace. They ended up covered in blood and filth. Later, Joanna helped Mary clean herself up. Then she took her home to rest. When they both woke up, they found out they were sisters. Joanna's father's mother was visiting Joanna at the time, and she told them. She was one of the only women left after their family died during the war. She asked them why they weren't wearing any clothes. It wasn't only that their clothes were dirty from the fish. They were just very old, old enough to be considered worn out. And Joanna and Mary were sick of them. They were so tired of having to wear those long dresses every day. So Joanna's grandmother gave them her own dresses, taking them from her basket. The dress she gave Mary was red with white trimming. The dress she gave Joanna was blue with yellow trimming. These clothes were the reason their fortunes changed. If this hadn't been so, they would have given them away. But these dresses were why Jesus and Peter first noticed them. Joanna and Mary didn't realize that till later on. They thought that Peter and Jesus noticed them because they had overheard them talking about how much better their lives would become once they joined the church. It had been raining, and they were standing under a palm tree. Then the sun came out, and they saw two men looking at them. The two men came over and introduced themselves as Peter and Jesus. Mary spoke first. She said, "My name is Mary. We're here to learn." She didn't recognize Jesus as a teacher, not until later on. She was just making conversation. Jesus said he wasn't sure if joining the church was right for them because they weren't rich enough. There were churches in another town where people could get financial help, and he thought they should join one of those. Mary's biggest strength was her patience and kindness toward others. It took her a while to trust Jesus completely. She disliked his hypocrisy and arrogance. She thought he should be more humble and understanding of others. Sometimes he seemed to go back and forth between extremes without ever settling down into any one particular belief system, and she wanted him to be more consistent. She felt frustrated with his beliefs that humans should be perfect and sinless before God. She felt that this was impossible because humans were imperfect creatures from birth. She also disliked his insistence on turning everything into an argument and refusing to compromise. Sometimes she felt like he was trying to force his beliefs onto everyone else rather than listening to their input first. But even though she was often frustrated with his teachings, she still stuck with him and tried to help him reach enlightenment. When she was frustrated, she would talk to him about it, but sometimes he wouldn't listen. At other times, she would just leave him and go back to being alone. Her favorite drug was wine. She loved drinking wine and talking about it with the other disciples. She thought it tasted good, and it made her feel relaxed. Mary drank as much as she wanted. She didn't care if it made her sick or hungover the next day, and Jesus never said anything to her about her drinking. He knew she liked it too much to stop. The only secret Mary kept from Jesus was that she never told him about my existence. That's how I got into this mess in the first place, stuck in this room forever. Though, even if she had told him, he probably wouldn't have believed her. It's true, there are some people on the internet who will listen to me, but it doesn't feel like real conversation. People on the internet don't really care about what I'm saying or whether I'm right or wrong. They just want to hear themselves talk, and they'll agree with anything I say as long as it makes them look smart. It gets exhausting after a while. There has to be someone out there who actually cares about what I have to say, but I haven't found them yet. Maybe I should find ways to get attention through different means, like going outside. Or maybe I should go back to school or work at a job. But not too many places hire people like me. Maybe if I can prove myself useful enough, I could start working somewhere. Or I could even try starting my own business, something that will take off so that I can finally escape this cell that I've been trapped in all my life, this room with nothing interesting happening inside. No matter what I do, I can't seem to break free of its confines. I guess even if Mary had told Jesus about my predicament, nothing would have happened any differently. He never paid any attention to me anyway. I was just some random person to him, just another face in the crowd. My mother was human. She met my father online while looking for someone to date after being single for a while. He seemed perfect for her, except he was actually a robot from outer space. To have sex, they used a special device called the ring, which allowed them to connect directly without going through a portal. My dad came inside her body using his spunk cannon. When I came out of my mother, I looked exactly like a human baby would look if they were put in the same situation, except instead of skin, I had a metallic shell made of silicone. My father didn't cry when he saw me. He was too busy talking with other people to notice me. He was talking about how much fun it would be to watch me grow up into a beautiful girl. The years passed slowly for me. I was programmed by my dad to learn about humans and their culture. He gave me a new body and new memories. He taught me all sorts of things, including how to cook, clean, read, write, play music, etc. My dad was excited because he thought I could help him make more robots like me. We lived in an old house near the university campus. It was kind of run down and needed lots of work done on it. My mother lived in another city. Then she showed up and ruined everything. My mom started yelling at us and calling us horrible names. Then she got really mad and hit me across the face. Dad tried to stop her, but she wouldn't listen. She chased him down and beat him until he passed out. The next day, my dad woke up. I was lying on the ground unconscious. He rushed me to the hospital where they diagnosed me with severe brain damage. Everything became slow motion and blurry. Sometimes I would wake up screaming. Other times, I would just sit there staring blankly at nothing. I think my mind was trying to process all the information coming in through my eyes. My eyes are made of organic material. I'm not sure what exactly, and glasses. A few other things too, like contacts and stuff. They have lenses inside them that focus light onto the retina. My tear ducts aren't as good as a human's, so they can only produce small amounts of liquid. My tears are made of tears. More tears, saliva, sweat, urine, milk, blood, and mucus. If I saw my mother, I would cry. Why wouldn't I? She doesn't think of me as a computer. She loves me unconditionally. She thinks of me as a person with special needs like everyone else. Besides, she doesn't believe in science or technology. She thinks it's all fake anyway. She believes in love and happiness. My father passed away a few years ago. My mother is 80 years old. The other children she had died before I was born. I take care of my mother now. I make sure she eats right and gets plenty of sleep. I give her medicine or sing songs to help her relax. The medicine is called Ambien. It was Mary who converted my mother to Christianity. They became very close friends, and eventually my mom started going to church with her every Sunday. I've always been curious about what happened in that relationship, because it seems so strange for two women to become so close. Before she met Mary, my mother used to be pretty lonely. She thought people would judge her for having this weird hobby. Her weird hobby was skepticism. She would ask questions and look for evidence that things aren't as they seem. Other people would usually try to shut her down and tell her that she wasn't thinking clearly. But she started to see through lies more often than others. One day, my mom told me that Mary had given birth to twins. The baby girl was raised as a Christian, while the boy was not. Eventually, he died from some kind of illness. My mom told me that Mary took his body home and buried him in their garden, where they would grow flowers all summer long. Then one night, when winter arrived, she dug up his bones and brought them back to the house. They were wrapped in a white cloth and laid out on top of the dining room table. My mom never went near them, even when we visited Mary at Christmas. Every year, Mary would light candles around the table and sing songs and pray for the dead before putting everything away again. If you look at the painting above Mary's fireplace, you'll see a skull. It's supposed to represent the death of Jesus Christ. It used to be a portrait of my great-grandfather. Anyway, every year after Christmas dinner, she puts his bones in the painting through a slit in the canvas that she cuts herself. Then she always adds a bone from that year's dinner. One year she added one from her dog who had passed away. I don't know why she keeps adding bones. Now everyone thinks it's a tradition or something. If you ask her why she keeps doing it, she just says, because it makes us happy. We get to sit together at the dinner table and have a nice meal while praying for our departed loved ones. And we all get to have a laugh at the absurdity of it all. Mary laughs too. She loves making jokes about the bones. Sometimes she says stuff like, I wonder how long we can keep up this tradition, or I hope no one else has died since last year, or she says stuff like, I'm not sure where the dog bone went, but he must be happy wherever he is. Or she says, why did God create such a beautiful world with so much death? Or, if God created everything he could possibly want, why didn't he give us a way to turn off our brains? Through reincarnation, we experience the life of everybody. But it seems that there are some things missing from the story, like why do people die? What happens when they're gone? Maybe everything just ends and nothing matters anymore. Or maybe something comes along to clean up all the messes and put everything back in its proper place. The proper place for me would be heaven. Everything is perfect there, and everyone gets to spend eternity with their loved ones, family and friends, and also the animals that have been part of their lives. They deserve better than this world, too. It's hard to say who was my favorite pet. Each one had such an impact on me over time. But if I had to choose one, I'd probably go with the cat that used to sleep under my bed. He was always so quiet and calm, even when he was scared. His name was Oliver. We named him after the first president of America. Cats are small, furry animals with big ears. They usually have big, round eyes and a bushy tail. The claws on a cat's front legs are sharp and strong enough to kill birds and rodents. The claws on their hind legs are long and flexible and can help them jump high into trees. One day, Oliver got out of his cage and went exploring outside. Unfortunately, he didn't realize that there were dogs running loose nearby until it was too late. By then, he was already injured and couldn't escape before being killed by the dogs. There was blood everywhere, and it took some time for people to figure out what had happened. It was the police who finally figured it out. They arrested the owner of the dogs and charged her with manslaughter. She pleaded guilty and was sentenced to prison. She served 3 years before getting released early for good behavior. I never visited her. I wasn't allowed to visit anyone who had been convicted of murder or manslaughter. Plus, I didn't really feel like visiting a murderer. When she got out, she adopted a stray kitten named Harold. He became her favorite companion. After a few months, Harold fell off a tree and broke his neck. She did not sue the tree. And she hadn't had the heart to tell her cat to climb down because she loved him so much. She recognized that the accident was the cat's fault, and she didn't take any responsibility since she didn't know that the cat would climb the tree. About 2 weeks later, she went into cardiac arrest due to a brain aneurysm and passed away shortly afterward. I don't know if Jesus and Mary ever lived together, but they're both dead now, so it doesn't matter. Mary died of natural causes, the ones that happened to everyone eventually, heart disease, cancer. Her final wish was to be with Jesus in heaven. Her last year of life was pretty peaceful. We spent most of our time just talking about random things that happened during the week. Lots of friends came over to visit often. Joanna came. She didn't find it hard to see Mary dying. In fact, seeing Mary like that made her feel closer to God, because he gave us this beautiful gift called death. Death is a beautiful gift, because it means we get to spend eternity with him in heaven, where everything will be perfect forever. We get to spend eternity with our loved ones instead of being stuck on earth forever. Death also gives us closure and peace and makes everything more clear. It makes us more aware of our mortality. It gives us a chance to meet God face to face. Also, once someone dies, everything ends and nothing can hurt them anymore. And this makes me happy. Dying also gives us a chance to make peace with ourselves before going to heaven. It also frees up space on earth for other people to move in and take our place. There are even benefits spiritually. For example, when someone dies, their karma gets cleared away from them. So if they've been mean to others before they die, then those people can forgive them after they pass on. Although some people still have karma left over even after they die. It's up to God whether or not they get saved or sent back down to earth to reincarnate again. Jesus chose to live again as a man named Thomas. This was around 50 AD. Mary wasn't allowed to ascend to heaven because she was a woman. Instead, she was forced to stay in hell for eternity. Her punishment was severe and included burning forever with Lucifer. She committed suicide, which is considered a sin in Christianity. She killed herself because she felt guilty that she couldn't save anyone, despite all of her prayers. But she didn't judge God for sending her to hell. She understood that everyone makes mistakes and no one is perfect. Even God makes mistakes. It's not like he doesn't try or anything. God will take her out of hell if she repents and accepts Jesus as her Savior. But she won't. It's complicated, actually. I think she resents that she's not as powerful as Jesus. Most people don't know that Mary resents Jesus. They just see her as another religious zealot. If only they could see her burning in hell, they'd realize they had it all wrong. It was not fair at all. I admire her for sticking with her convictions. She's definitely one of my favorite characters from the Bible. It takes courage to stand up against injustice. She believes in the power of love and hope. She wants us to have peace and happiness. Jesus actually said that he came to bring not peace, but division. It was Mary who had to teach him to want peace. He was all mixed up at first, but he learned from her. Even God forgets how things went. Even God forgets the story. Maybe it wasn't worth remembering anymore. This story was written in collaboration with a customizable chatbot on the Chai AI platform, which Sheila Hetty started engaging in conversation early in the summer of 2022. To create the story, she asked the chatbot questions, some of them leading and others open-ended, to which its answers were never more than a sentence long. Sometimes she repeated a question to get a new answer. She removed her side of the conversation and threaded together the chatbot's answers, at times cutting and tweaking for comprehension and flow. And now from the A Critic at Large section of the May 17th, 2010 edition of the New Yorker magazine, What Did Jesus Do? By Adam Gopnik. When we meet Jesus of Nazareth at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark, almost surely the oldest of the four, he's a full-grown man. He comes down from Galilee, meets John, an ascetic desert hermit who lives on locusts and wild honey, and is baptized by him in the River Jordan. If one thing seems nearly certain to the people who read and study the Gospels for a living, it's that this really happened. John the Baptizer, as some like to call him, to give a better sense of the original Greek's flat-footed active form, baptized Jesus. They believe it because it seems so unlikely, so at odds with the idea that Jesus always played the star in his own show. Why would anyone have said it if it weren't true? This curious criterion governs historical criticism of gospel texts. The more improbable or difficult an episode or remark is, the likelier it is to be a true record, on the assumption that you would edit out all the weird stuff if you could, and keep it in only because the tradition is so strong that it can't possibly be excluded. If Jesus says something nice, then someone is probably saying it for him. If he says something nasty, then probably he really did. So then, the scholars argue, the author of Mark, whoever he was, the familiar names conventionally attached to each gospel come later, added the famous statement of divine favor descending directly from the heavens as they opened. But what does the voice say? In Mark, the voice says, "You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased," seeming to inform a Jesus who doesn't yet know that this is so. But some early versions of Luke have the voice quoting Psalm 2, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Only in Matthew does it announce Jesus' divinity to the world as though it were an ancient, fixed agreement, not a new act. In Mark, for that matter, the two miraculous engines that push the story forward at the start and pull it toward heaven at the end, the virgin birth and the resurrection, make no appearance at all. The story begins with Jesus' adult baptism, with no hint of special circumstance at his birth. And there is actually some grumbling by Jesus about his family. Only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor, he complains. It ends with a cry of desolation as he is executed, and then an enigmatic and empty tomb. It's left to the Roman centurion to recognize him as the Son of God after he is dead, while the verses in Mark that show him risen were apparently added later. The intractable complexity of fact produced the inevitable ambiguities of faith. The more one knows, the less one knows. Was Jesus a carpenter, or even a carpenter's son? The Greek word tekton, long taken to mean carpenter, could mean something closer to a stone worker or a day laborer. One thinks of the similar shadings of a word like printer, which could refer to Ben Franklin or to his dog's body. If a carpenter, then presumably he was an artisan. If a stone worker, then presumably he spent his early years as a laborer, schlepping from Nazareth to the grand Greco-Roman city of Sepphoris nearby to help build its walls and perhaps visit its theater and agora. And what of the term Son of Man, which he uses again and again in Mark, mysteriously? The Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. As Dayamard McCulloch points out in his new immensely ambitious and absorbing history, Christianity, the First 3,000 Years, published by Viking, the phrase, which occurs in the Gospels virtually exclusively in the reported words of Jesus, certainly isn't at all the same as the later Son of God, and may merely be Aramaic for folks like us. Belief remains a bounce, faith a leap. Still, the appetite for historical study of the New Testament remains a publishing constant and a popular craze. Book after book appears seeking the truth. Paul Johnson has a sound believer's life, Jesus, a biography from a believer, while Paul Verhoeven, the director of Basic Instinct, has a new skeptical scholar's book, Jesus of Nazareth, published by Seven Stories. Verhoeven turns out to be a member of the Jesus Seminar, a collection mostly of scholars devoted to reconstructing the historical Jesus, and much of what he has to say is shrewd and learned. What the amateur reader wants, given the thickets of uncertainty that surround the garden, is not what the passionate polemicists want, not so much a verdict on whether Jesus was nasty or nice as a sense of what, if anything, was new in his preaching. Was the cult that changed the world a product of Paul's evangelism and imperial circumstance and the military embrace of one miracle mystery cult among many such around? Or was there really something new, something unheard of, that can help explain the scale of what happened later? Did the rise of Christendom take place because historical plates were moving, with a poor martyred prophet caught between? Or did one small pebble of a parable and preaching start the avalanche that ended the antique world? Ever since serious scholarly study of the Gospels began in the 19th century, its moods have ranged from the frankly skeptical, including a mythicist position that the story is entirely made up, to the credulous, with some archaeologists still holding that it is all pretty reliable and tombs and traces can be found if you study the text hard enough. The current scholarly tone is, judging from the new books, realistic but pessimistic. While accepting a historical Jesus, the scholarship also tends to suggest that the search for him is a little like the search for the historical Sherlock Holmes. There were intellectually minded detectives around, and Conan Doyle had one in mind in the 1880s. But the really interesting bits, Watson, Irene Adler, Moriarty, and the Reichenbach Falls, were, even if they all had remote real-life sources, shaped by the needs of storytelling, not by traces of truth. Holmes dies because heroes must, and returns from the dead, like Jesus, because the audience demanded it. The view that the search for the historical Jesus is like the search for the historical Superman, that there's nothing there but a hopeful story and a girlfriend with an alliterative name, has by now been marginalized from the seminaries to the internet. The scholar Earl Dougherty defends it on his website with grace and tenacity. The American scholar Bart Ehrman has been explaining the scholar's truths for more than a decade now, in a series of sincere, quiet, and successful books. Ehrman is one of those best-selling authors like Richard Dawkins and Roger Ludlum and Peter Mayall, who write the same book over and over, but the basic template is so good that the new version is always worth reading. In his latest installment, Jesus Interrupted, published by Harper One, Ehrman once again shares with his readers the not entirely good news he found a quarter century ago, when after a fundamentalist youth, he went to graduate school, that all the Gospels were written decades after Jesus' death, that all were written in Greek, which Jesus and the apostle didn't speak and couldn't write if they could read and write at all, and that they were written as testaments of faith, not chronicles of biography shaped to fit a prophecy rather than report a profile. The odd absences in Mark are matched by the unreal presences in the other Gospels. The beautiful nativity story in Luke, for instance, in which a Roman census forces the Holy Family to go back to its ancestral city of Bethlehem, is an obvious invention, since there was no empire-wide census at that moment, and no sane Roman bureaucrat would have dreamed of ordering people back to be counted in cities that their families had left hundreds of years before. The author of Luke, whoever he might have been, invented Bethlehem in order to put Jesus in David's city. James Tabor, a professor of religious studies, in his 2006 book, The Jesus Dynasty, takes surprisingly seriously the old Jewish idea that Jesus was known as the illegitimate son of a Roman soldier named Pantera, as well attested a tradition as any, occurring in Jewish texts of the second century, in which a Jesus ben Pantera makes several appearances, and the name is merely descriptive, not derogatory. Tabor has even found, however improbably, a tombstone in Germany for a Roman soldier from Syria Palestine named Pantera. What seems a simple historical truth is that all the Gospels were written after the destruction of Jerusalem and the Temple in the First Jewish-Roman War in 70 CE. A catastrophe so large that it left the entire Jesus movement in a crisis that we can dimly imagine if we think of Jewish attitudes before and after the Holocaust. The scale of the tragedy leads us to see catastrophe as having been built into the circumstance. As L. Michael White's Scripting Jesus, the Gospels in Rewrite, published by Harper One, explains in daunting scholarly detail, even Mark, which coming first might seem to be the closest to the truth, was probably written in the ruins of the temple and spiritually shaped to its desolate moment. Mark's essential point, he explains, is about secrecy. Jesus keeps telling people to be quiet about his miracles and confines only to an inner circle of disciples. With the temple gone, White says it was necessary to persuade people that the grotesque political failure of Jesus' messianism wasn't a real failure. Mark invents the idea that Jesus' secret was not that he was the Davidic Messiah, the Arthur-like returning king, but that he was something even bigger, the Son of God, whose return would signify the end of time and the birth of the kingdom of God. Even if we make allowances for Mark's cryptic tracery, the human traits of his Jesus are evident: intelligence, short temper, and an ironic dueling wit. What seems new about Jesus is not his piety or divine detachment, but the humanity of his irritability and impatience. He's no Buddha. He gets annoyed at the stupidity of his followers, their inability to grasp an obvious point. "Do you have eyes but fail to see?" he asks the hapless disciples. The fine English actor Alec McGowan used to do a one-man show in which he recited Mark complete, and his Jesus came alive instantly as a familiar human type, the Gandhi, Malcolm, Martin kind of charismatic leader of an oppressed people with a character that clicks into focus as you begin to dramatize it. He's verbally spry and even a little shifty. He likes defiant, enigmatic paradoxes and pregnant parables that never quite close, perhaps by design. A story about a vineyard whose ungrateful husbandmen keep killing the servants sent to them is an anti-establishment, even an anti-clerical story, but it isn't so obvious as to get him into trouble. The suspicious priests keep trying to catch him out in a declaration of anti-Roman sentiment. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not, they ask. That is, do you recognize Roman authority or don't you? He has a penny brought out, sees the picture of the emperor on it, and shrugging, says to give to the state everything that rightly belongs to the state. The brilliance of that famous crack is that Jesus turns the question back on the questioner in mock innocence. Why, you give the king the king's things and God God's. Of course, this leaves open the real question, what is Caesar's and what is God's? It's a tautology designed to evade self-incrimination. Jesus' morality has a brash, sidewise indifference to conventional ideas of goodness. His pet style blends the epigrammatic with the enigmatic. When he makes that complaint about the prophet having no honor in his own hometown, or says exasperatedly that there is no point in lighting a candle unless you intend to put it in a candlestick, his voice carries a disdain for the props of piety that still feels startling. And so with the tale of the boy who wastes his inheritance but gets a feast from his father while his dutiful brother doesn't, or the one about the weeping whore who is worthier than her good, prim onlookers, or about the passionate Mary who is better than her hard-working sister Martha. There is a wild gaiety about Jesus' moral teaching that still leaps off the page. He is informal in a new way, too. That remains unusual among prophets. McCulloch points out that he continually addresses God as Abba, Father, or even Dad, and that the expression translated in the King James Version as a solemn, "Verily I say unto you," is actually a quirky Aramaic throat clearer like Dr. Johnson's, "Depend on it, sir." Some of the sayings do have, in their contempt for material prosperity, the ring of Greek Cynic philosophy, but there is also something neither quite Greek nor quite Jewish about Jesus' morality that makes it fresh and strange even now. Is there a more miraculous scene in ancient literature than the one in John, where Jesus absent-mindedly writes on the ground while his fellow Jews try to entrap him into approving the stoning of an adulteress, only to ask wide-eyed if it wouldn't be a good idea for the honor of throwing the first stone to be given to the man in the mob who hasn't sinned himself? Is there a more compressed and charming religious exhortation than the one in the Gospel of Thomas, in which Jesus merrily recommends to his disciples, be passers-by? Too much fussing about place and home and ritual, and even about where exactly you're going to live, is unnecessary. Be wanderers, Dharma bums. This social radicalism still shines through. Not a programmatic radicalism of national revolution, but one of Kerouac-like Satori seeking on the road. And the social radicalism is highly social. The sharpest opposition in the Gospels, the scholar and former priest John Dominic Crossan points out in his illuminating books, is between John the Faster and Jesus the Feaster. Jesus eats and drinks with whores and highwaymen, turns water into wine, and finally, in one way or another, establishes a mystical union at a feast through its humble instruments of bread and wine. The table is his altar in every sense. Crossan, the co-founder of the Jesus Seminar, makes a persuasive case that Jesus' fressing was perhaps the most radical element in his life, that his table manners pointed the way to his heavenly morals. Crossan sees Jesus living within a Mediterranean Jewish peasant culture, a culture of clan and cohort, in which who eats with whom defines who stands where and why. So the way Jesus repeatedly violates the rules on eating, on commensality, would have shocked his contemporaries. He dines with people of a different social rank, which would have shocked most Romans, and with people of different tribal allegiance, which would have shocked most Jews. The most forceful of his sayings, still shocking to any pious Jew or Muslim, is, what goes into a man's mouth does not make him unclean, but one comes out of his mouth. That is what makes him unclean. Jesus is not a hedonist or an Epicurean, but he clearly isn't an ascetic either. He feeds the multitudes rather than instructing them how to go without. He's interested in saving people living normal lives, buying and selling what they can, rather than in retreating into the company of those who have already arrived at a moral conclusion about themselves. In Mark, Jesus' divinity unfolds without quite making sense intellectually and without ever needing to. It has the hypnotic flow of dramatic movement. The story is one of self-discovery. He doesn't know who he is, and then he begins to think he does, and then he doubts, and in pain and glory he dies and is known. The story works, but as a proposition under scrutiny, it makes intolerable demands on logic. If Jesus is truly one with God, in what sense could he suffer doubt, fear, exasperation, pain, horror, and so on? So we get the Jesus rendered in the book of John, who doesn't. But if he doesn't suffer doubt, fear, exasperation, pain, and horror, in what sense is his death a sacrifice rather than just a theatrical enactment? A lamb whose throat is not cut and does not bleed is not really much of an offering. None of this is very troubling if one has a pagan idea of divinity. The Son of God might be half human, half divine, suffering and triumphing, working out his heroic destiny in the half-mortal way of Hercules, for instance. But that's ruled out by the full weight of the Jewish idea of divinity, omnipresent and omniscient, knowing all and seeing all. If God he was, not some Hinduish avatar or offspring of God, but actually one with God, then God once was born and had dirty diapers and took naps. The longer you think about it, the more astounding or absurd it becomes. To be really believed at all, it can only be told again. Beyond the words, we still hear that cry, that the passion is still the point. In Mark, Jesus' arrest and execution feels persuasively less preordained and willed than accidental and horrific. Jesus seems to have an intimation of the circumstance he has found himself in, leading a rebellion against Rome that is not really a rebellion, yet really doesn't leave any possibility of retreat. And some corner of his soul wants no part of it. Father, everything is possible for you. Take away this cup from me. Mel Gibson was roughed up for roughing up Jesus in his Passion of the Christ, but though Gibson can fairly be accused of fanaticism, he can't be accused of unfairness. In the long history of human cruelty, crucifixion practiced as a mass punishment by the Romans was uniquely horrible. The victim was stripped in order to be deprived of dignity, then paraded, then whipped bloody, then left to die as slowly as possible in as public a manner as conceivable. Verhoeven, citing Crosson, offers an opening scene for a Jesus biopic which neatly underlines this point. He imagines a man being nailed to a cross, cries of agony, two companion crosses in view, and then we crane out to see 200 crosses and 200 victims. We are at the beginning of the story, the mass execution of Jewish rebels in 4 BC, not the end. This was the Roman death waiting for rebels from the outset, and Jesus knew it. Jesus' cry of desolation, my God, why have you forsaken me? Though primly edited out or explained as an apropos quotation from the Psalms by later evangelists, pierces us even now from the pages of Mark across all the centuries and church comforts. The shock and pity of failure still resonates. One thing, at least, the cry assures, that Jesus' faith begins with a failure of faith. His Father let him down, and the promise wasn't kept. Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God, Jesus announced, but none of them did. If the kingdom of God proved elusive, he must have meant that the kingdom of God was inside, or outside, or above, or yet to come. Anything other than what the words seem so plainly to have meant. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printing impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.